I'm going to talk to you today about medical legal partnerships. I'm here on behalf of the National Center for Medical Legal Partnerships based out of Boston. We've done two presentations. We did a panel with the Health Law Group yesterday, and so I'm here again to sort of talk about these with public health nursing. And there's a reason we're here and that we've applied to present to this group is because we think that you all have a lot to offer this movement, but you're totally and completely invisible. And that is an interesting finding. And so I wanted to come and talk to you about what that means for nursing, et cetera. So without any further ado, I too have nothing to disclose. We have not figured out a way to make money off of this. So what we are talking about today in this theme of social justice, I guess this presentation is really the action piece of that, which is how do we operationalize changing the conditions in which our patients find themselves and present to us? And what tools do we have or don't we have, and how do we work in a transdisciplinary way to sort of take this story, for example, and I'm sitting out watching this thinking, as a lawyer and a community health nurse, like, well, you know, I actually think you guys could probably stop studying this issue, right? Like, I think it's time to file some lawsuits, right? Like, so it's very interesting as we get different perspectives. I sort of think longitudinal study, I'm thinking, actually, I think you're good. You're done. Y'all can move on to something else. But it's very interesting. So I wanted to do I'm going to do this. I have more slides in here than I'm going to spin that I'm going to talk about. So I'm going to fast forward through a few, and you can see them, I think, on the e-learning system, or you could just email me and I'll give them to you. I'll talk to you about Jackie. We'll talk about the big challenge, which is how to mitigate social determinants of illness and not just study them or not acknowledge them. I mean, as community health nurses, we are very guilty of this. But it is transforming our understanding, our evangelizing about the social term, which we're very good at, into action. Talking about how we engage in collaborative transdisciplinary advocacy, which is a complex process that nursing and other disciplines in healthcare in particular are very bad at. We have these silos that we build, and we love to talk about silos, and I know that's a little cliche, but it's true. And finally, I want to talk to you about where all the nurses are in these movements, and when we get to the action steps of policy initiatives, there is just this complete and utter absence of a nursing voice. And I'm generalizing to some extent, because it's more effective in a presentation to make broad generalizations, but understand I'm painting with a broad brush, and I exclude all of you who, of course, are completely active. So you know, please don't throw any tomatoes. So I want to introduce you to a patient. This is a patient that you may have seen. This is a 7-year-old girl. She comes to her pediatrician's office frequently with poorly controlled asthma, which is a common childhood problem, especially in poor communities. She comes today, she's got more moderate shortness of breath, and she's not responding to a rescue inhaler. So whatever, she keeps using it, doesn't work. Mom is in a hurry to get in and out. Mom is annoyed she's here. Mom is rude to the staff. Mom is rude to you. She's short with everybody. The physician knows this patient pretty well. The patient's shy. She's a 7-year-old girl. I've got a 6-year-old daughter who's not shy, but this woman is shy. And that's not an unusual finding. It's a data point, right? During the exam, the child's clothing appears worn. She's not real laundered, but she's not dirty or unkempt. It's just, you know, she obviously is of low means and maybe is not, you know, the hygiene level is not where the physician would like to see it. But nothing that you'd call the social worker in for or anything of that nature. The child's nourished, but her weight sort of comes on and off the curve. You know, this is a very typical presentation in a community health setting, right? This is, especially with asthma, this is what you see. You see these kids with recidivist ER visits. You usually see them in the ER come in like this, right? You know, and the complaint is, you know, my son or daughter, they can't breathe, and they give them an albuterol neb, and then they send them home. So if we look at the traditional medical model and we start asking what's wrong with Jackie, I think we can all agree that she can't breathe. Do we all agree there? Okay. Well, these are really, you know, we do this with students sometime. You're like, let's go step by step. So I'm not trying to sort of belittle you, but I think that there's a point at which I might lose you. And so you know, we have to at least agree on some things at the start. So we know she can't breathe, and that's a good and important finding. And for the most part, we're spot on. Maybe she's poorly clothed or dirty. Who knows? That's like a really tough call. Everyone's so afraid to chart that kind of stuff because then it leads to some CPS intervention or something. We've got this really blunt instrument to handle sort of these sort of problems. Maybe she's underweight, maybe she's not. I guess it all depends on what kind of provider you are. I was telling the group yesterday that I have a family practitioner that cares for all my members of my family, and I think we'd have to come in basically dead before he would do anything, which makes paying the copay for that visit a really interesting proposition because we just talk for 20 minutes. Maybe she's living in a difficult situation at home. I don't know. Or maybe mom's just ticked off because the pediatrician's office only opens from 9 to 4. And she works 3 jobs and can't get there and had to take the bus 7 ways, right? I mean, who knows what's going on? Maybe there's other stuff we haven't seen that's underneath this that is going on in this child's life. So all of this happens in this like 4-minute to 3-minute, 30-second to 4-minute clinical encounter, right? So it's like a 7-minute appointment, but the actual clinical encounter is very short. You auscultate the lungs, you sit and you pause, you make the empathetic face. Next thing you know, you're out of visit time. All right. So the traditional medical course of treatment for this kid is pretty standard. So if you can't breathe, we'd give you a NEB. We'd change your asthma medication, and luckily there's just a gajillion medications now for asthma, so we keep tweaking that. We like to give kids peak visual flow charts, right, or give them devices to take home. And this is all because all of our medication regimen for asthma is based on compliance, right? When kids don't have controlled asthma, there's really only 2 reasons in the clinical sort of decision tree. Either we're pharmacologically not managing it well, or you're not doing what we told you to do, because we know that asthma can be controlled, therefore it's your fault, right? We call compliance adherence now, but it's still just as rude. So what happens? Well, we do this and she still can't breathe. So she keeps coming back and back and back. This costs millions of dollars, by the way. So even if you just don't like people and you need other reasons to care about this issue, this is very expensive, okay? Maybe she's poorly clothed, maybe she's not. Again, what are you going to do with this? Really nothing. These are just sort of these ambiguous data points that are really tricky for clinicians. This, by the way, is why no one goes into primary care if you talk to physicians. What do you do with this? What do you do with this, honestly? This is a very tricky patient with a very simple physiological problem. There's nothing complex about this diagnosis. There's really nothing complex about the treatment. The nursing interventions are very simple. They're not necessarily complex when we think about patient education. But there's all this psychosocial, there's all this community stuff that's just embedded in here, which is frankly just a mess, all right? Now, that's not to say that these interventions aren't important, because, you know, my wife has asthma, and when she can't breathe, I very much value that the physician makes her breathe in and out, right? We value that in our family, and we communicate about that very clearly to the doctor. So this is not to say that simply changing the medication or doing those things is bad, right? It just doesn't really do anything, right, long term. So let's talk about what's going on. So she can't breathe, so we'll do the 5 whys. So why can't she breathe? Well, she can't breathe because her airway is obstructed. Why is her airway obstructed? Well, she's got some sort of, you know, poorly controlled reactive airway disease of some kind. Okay, we're all still on board, all right? So why does she have this disease? Well, maybe she's not taking her meds. Maybe there's some environmental triggers. Maybe there's some underlying pathology. Maybe she has some things we don't even know about that we have to do imaging to figure out. Well, why is that occurring? Well, this is it, right? Forget about it. I can't go here, right? I'm just the doctor in the room or the nurse practitioner or the PA. I'm done. And that's actually not an unreasonable position. If I was a clinical provider, which I'm not, but if I was a nurse practitioner and I had a 5-minute appointment window, it would not be unreasonable nor unethical for me to, I think, say, stop, I'm fulfilling the mandate you've asked me to fulfill. I'm done, I can't do any more right now. But the problem is it leads to lots of burnout and frustration among providers who really recognize that they're not getting to sort of the deep part of the onion. So let's do it again and put on a different set of hats. So when we ask different people these questions, you get different answers. This is, of course, the big point about transdisciplinarity. So I have this sort of schizophrenic career path. When I look at this question, I sort of think about it slightly differently. It's not right or wrong, it's just different. So if you ask me why she can't breathe, I acknowledge these things, I'm interested in them, but I want to get to this last piece, right? And the reason she can't breathe is because her landlord has her living in this crappy apartment, right? So it's not just enough to say that it's the rodent feces that's triggering her asthma. That isn't why she has asthma. The rodent is a proximate cause, if you will. If you looked at torts, right? This is a proximate cause. The reason the rodent is in the house is because someone did something. And that something was you violated a law or you ignored some environmental condition. So if you're a physician and you realize this is the cause, how frustrating must your life be, right? So why do we continue to treat people without changing what makes them sick? This is just absolutely absurd to me. And luckily, and I know it all is to you, because that's why we're here at the APHA conference, right? So this is really easy presentation, because you've all, you know, we've all had the Kool-Aid, so we're all on board. This is not a commonly accepted way of thinking about healthcare. And the reason we don't do it is because we're not trained to clinically treat the social determinants of illness. Now, we may know what they are. We may tell community health nurses how to identify them or, you know, use studies, but we don't actually train people how to fix them. And that's a mistake, because providers can and should fix them, especially if that fix will fix the patient. We've got a lot of not my job-itis because we're not really giving people the right tools to do that. Now, what we don't propose creating super community health nurses or super physicians who can do these things. We have a plan. We've got a plan for that. And that plan is sort of thinking about a collaborative transdisciplinary way, and that's called the medical legal partnership model. Dr. Barry Zuckerman is a pediatrician in Boston. He came up with Reach Out and Read. You may be familiar with this, books in pediatrician's office. So he had these kids that kept coming with recidivist asthma into his ER in Boston. They just kept coming and coming and coming. And he finally realized this connection of they live in these bad places where they have these legal problems. And so he, because he's a physician, was like, well, I'm gonna write a letter to a landlord. So he drafts this letter, and of course the landlord gets the letter, and it's Dr. Barry Zuckerman, who's a very tall guy, you know, he's an imposing figure, and the landlord's like, yeah, that's whatever, right? Throws it away. But he calls his lawyer, right, the guy that does his will, and he says, you know, I don't know what his name is, John, let's just say it's John. John, will you write a letter? And John's like, of course, you pay me a lot of money to do your work, I'll do whatever you want. John writes a letter, and suddenly the landlord's like, absolutely, let's abate the thing. And guess what? The kid stops coming to the ER. So he gets these anecdotal evidence that these interventions are working, and he starts making a decision about the best use of his time. So is the best use of my time in the exam room counseling the patients? Well, what if we told you no? I mean, what would that feel like as a provider if I told you that a lot of what you're doing may actually not be helping the patient, and in fact, by diverting your attention away from the true cause, you actually might be doing more harm? That's a big sea change for folks, and it would require this huge leap in change. Well, medical legal partnerships are the practice of law as healthcare. This is not a lawyer and a doctor getting together and helping. It is a lawyer practicing healthcare and a healthcare practitioner practicing law. It is an extraordinarily different way of thinking about the delivery of legal services. So literally, we have lawyers who are embedded into clinics all around the country. The largest, at the Pediatric Center at Boston Hospital right now, the largest group of employees in the pediatrics department are lawyers. There are 9 full-time lawyers on staff. There are 15 full-time pediatricians. So they literally have offices next to each other. The lawyers are treated as consultants just like you would an infectious disease doctor. They see patients, they chart in the records. They are essentially acting as healthcare providers. The focus is on preventive law. When you see patients come in, how do we get them to not come in again? And we, you know, I've sort of talked to you about some of the things we do. I'm going to give you an example of a case because this might seem somewhat abstract. We had a case of a immigrant family that lived in a neighborhood where there was no wall. So, you know, that may not be a big deal in some areas, but Indianapolis, where I'm from, is sort of cold. It's definitely gray and damp. As I think the British would say, there's a lot of damp conditions. And if you don't have a wall, it's quite difficult to sort of be healthy, it turns out. Lots of bad things happen, mold and all sorts of things. But they wouldn't do anything about it because the landlord was this giant slumlord who had all these illegals living in this house. And so if they said anything, he would report them and everyone would go to jail and it would be terrible. And the lawyers got involved through one of the MLPs, and this is a case that I worked on with a colleague of mine, and what we found was that it would be impossible to sort of take on this person's case without hurting them further, because indeed, if we filed suit, they would surely be deported, or they'd have to go to ICE, or there'd be some problem. So we actually just rezoned the neighborhood. And that was an interesting action. It didn't take long, actually. We condemned all this guy's houses, and we rezoned the neighborhood to a commercial center. We had a problem of relocating people, but we did that, and we did it successfully. So there's these interesting way of thinking about what the health intervention is. And I'll give you another example of cases as we go forward. I'm going to skip through this, but the slide that I want you to point out is that there's a continuum from direct legal assistance for individuals to sort of changing the way institutions practice to sort of affecting policy change. So a medical legal partnership that would be quite successful, for example, in, I don't know, California prisons, might, for example, pair clinicians working on issues such as this ridiculous idea that you should have to pay to get a TB shot with a very easy and quick lawsuit, which I'm guessing would not take long, that would actually be affecting a huge amount of change. And it would be really exciting to then take your community health students and have them work with the lawyers on it. And that's what I want to talk to you about you next, is where are nurses fitting into this model? We call it medical legal partnerships. It's a bad name because it's social workers and nurses and all sorts of people. And we need a better name because we do, by our language, sort of, you know, devalue the rest of the people that are providing health care. So I'm going to skip through these and encourage you to look. But I do want to tell you that there are a lot of MLPs in the United States. There's 225 across the country. They vary from, you know, very simple programs to very robust programs. I talked to you a little bit about this idea of transdisciplinarity and what we mean, and I'm going to skip through that. But at the end of the day, we're talking about getting away from the practice of medicine in isolation. In fact, what I would propose to you that what we have to do is get away from the practice of anything. So, you know, there's nothing more frustrating to me than being in a care team where we go around and we say, what is social work's perspective on this? What is nursing's perspective on this? Well, the fact is that is what got us into this problem in the first place. We should really be healthcare practitioners of some kind. We have to come up with a new name for ourselves because we come with all this baggage. True, fact, physicians don't know about the law. Nurses typically don't know about the law. Lawyers don't know anything about nursing or medicine, right? These are just sort of facts. So, this is a very simple fix. This is like, it's not brain surgery, folks. We have to figure out a way to fix this to improve health. This is an example of the Indiana program. I'm going to skip through this slide. This is how it works. You have a patient with a problem. They go see their healthcare team. The healthcare team, this is like a magic part in this process, and it is very complicated, and we don't have time to go into it today. But the healthcare team makes some recognition that there's a problem that could be fixed with a legal intervention. That means they're essentially practicing law. You're asking a nurse or a doctor or whomever to make a filter and actually decide based on something that there's a fix here. That takes a huge amount of work, right? Tons of education and whatnot. They get a lawyer involved, the lawyer comes and everyone plays together and you get a result of some kind. And what we find is that the results are really outstanding. Wow. So what about the nurses? So the National Center for Medical Legal Partnership has tasked me and a few others to figure out why nurses in these MLPs aren't more engaged. There's an MLP conference every year, two nurse attendees out of like 500. When you go to talk to MLPs, nurses are absolutely and completely absent from these programs. There are a couple of reasons. One, nurses are basically invisible in most primary care settings, and I mean registered nurses, right? I mean, they just typically don't exist anymore. You get like an LPN or a technician at your doctor's office. So I think that's probably one reason. Many of these are focused in outpatient settings where nurses just aren't anymore, right? The public health nursing apparatus, as someone mentioned earlier, is just sort of just disintegrating around us. So that's one reason. The other thing is nurses are essentially commodities, right? We don't like to say this, but we just have to be honest with ourselves. Among teams, we typically are viewed as commodities. A nurse is a person that can be replaced. So it's not we really need Chad on this project because he's got some interesting thoughts. It's there should be a nurse on this team, right? And we don't do that with physicians necessarily, right? We tend to think differently about that. There seems to me, and we've done some very preliminary qualitative work on this, that the lack of self-efficacy about actual ability to change is a significant detraction for nurses to engage in this process. So for example, physicians are trained, whether we like it or not, to think that they can change things, right? That they have this ability to do things. Lawyers are certainly trained to do that. That's the whole point of going to law school. We actually don't teach nurses that. We teach nurses to change certain types of things, and it's not to say that, and again, I'm speaking in broad brushes, right? But if you ask the regular nurse on the street, could you fix, would you be able to take down an apartment? They'd say, well, clearly not. That's not my job, right? I don't have the right skills. A physician might say, well, I don't know if I could do it, but I could get someone who could, or I could pay, so I could think through. Nurses don't tend to think that way. So when we go into these clinics and we ask nurses, hey, what do you want to get involved, or what could you do? There's this reticence almost, and we don't know if it's lack of self-efficacy. I think the other thing is we don't really teach kids in nursing schools much about what it means to do nursing, right? We teach them a lot about how to provide patient care, but we have not, you know, advocacy is actually a statutory requirement in 30 states in the United States in nursing codes. What that means for nurses is radically different. That's a topic for another discussion. And we have not engaged specialized nurses who understand this, such as community health nurses. In Indiana, we no longer have a community health nursing program. So Lynn and I represent the last master's prepared community health nurses in the state of Indiana, right, who were educated there. So we have this problem. We have a lack of specialized nurses who understand these things, and we have not done a good enough outreach. So some of what I'm doing today is to sort of get in your heads the idea that could you conceive of training programs for your students where we go into these MLPs as clinical settings for community health nursing classes, which would just be ideal. We're doing that now in Indiana. Again, I'm out of time, but I'm going to just finish this slide, and then I'll shut up. We begin with this assumption, right, that this matters, and it does, and I'm really here to hopefully sell you that. I think this is what we need to do in the long term. We've got to somehow figure out how to get people learning together in the same room, because by the time they're adults, it's too late. You can imagine when I go into doctor's offices and they're like, the lawyer's here to help. You know, it's often not well received. And that's why you said, what do you call nurses at the beginning, or lawyers at the beginning? And I'm like, I know what I'm called frequently. And it's not good. So this sort of stuff is sort of critical to sort of figure out how we build capacity in individual nurses to think that they can be part of something like this, so that when they're in the transdisciplinary team, they're not just sitting there. When we have brought nurses in, oftentimes they feel as if they have nothing to offer. Or they'll say things like, well, we could talk about culturally competent care, right? I mean, they're just sort of reciting what we've told them to say, instead of, no, I can very easily make these physiological and social connections. That's what I'm trained to do as a nurse. I actually have a lot of value here. And so it's an interesting problem, and one we hope that through time and through many APHA conferences that this section and others can fix. Here's the paradox. Less nursing, more healthcare. It's de-nursifying the nurses' participation, which is difficult to sell to nurses. So, you know, hopefully one third of you have bought this and the rest haven't. I'm happy to take your questions now or after. So.